Scroll of Thoth, Episode 1, March 2013. You are listening to the Scroll of Thoth podcast on magic and occult counterculture with your hosts, James L. Wilbur and Colleen Kelly. Welcome to our first episode.
Hi, welcome. I hope you enjoy what you're about to hear.
Colleen, can you tell me a little bit about yourself for the people listening?
Sure. My name's Colleen Kelly. I am an ordained pagan minister. I was ordained through Cadnadan Yalu, which is a Welsh pagan church in Michigan. It actually translates as House of God and Goddess. I am the founder and director of IPPM, which is Indianapolis Pagan Prison Ministry, and we teach Asatru and Wicca in 6 of the state prisons here around Indiana.
I'm James L. Wilbur, editor of the Scroll of Thoth blog. I'm a game designer, writer, and pagan chaos magician. To let you know what you can expect from us, this podcast is going to be about all forms of magic, from Thelemic to chaos magic, pagan magic. We're going to talk about the roots of magic and how different people practice. And I also want to talk about how esotericism affects the culture at large and how it's affected by the culture. Maybe throw some lefty politics in there, stuff like that. Little rabble-rousing, that's the kind of thing I like. What would you like to talk about in the future?
There are a couple of topics that are near and dear to my heart, and one of them is the misunderstandings that so many people have about any religion that's not Abrahamic. By Abrahamic, I mean the three major religions, Christianity, Judaism, or sure. Islam. And so I would like to address that, particularly along the lines of morals and those types of things. And one of the major things that we teach in the prison are the 9 virtues. Both the Celts and the Nordic people had what they called the 9 virtues or the 9 values. And those are the things that talk about responsibility, courage, honor, and how you become a warrior. And understanding that a warrior is not a soldier, but a warrior is a leader who is not afraid to make sacrifices for the good of his tribe.
Pagans have values?
Pagans have many values.
Shocking, shocking. But for this first podcast, as I have promised a long time ago, we are going to play for you in its entirety Peter J. Carroll's talk on the philosophy and practice of magic. It was published in 2008, and the original Falcon Press has graciously given us permission to rebroadcast that. Go to originalfalcon.com, check out their catalog. They've got tons of books about magic and counterculture. You can find a link to that in our show notes. You've already listened to it. What should our listeners expect from this?
I think that they should expect to be challenged by a couple of things. One, he spoke several years ago and has a little bit of a different take than we in the United States might have on things. He uses terms in a way that you might want to look up so that you understand what he means by it. I got tripped on a couple of his terms, and I actually went and did a little bit of research on them while I was listening to the podcast.
He's very British and full of himself.
And very proper.
Yes.
The other is I was very surprised as I got into the podcast about how much I agreed with him. I expected not to. I expected him to be traditionally British in their observation of Wicca paganism and to have those types of ideals. I expected him to be a lot like Gerald Gardner. And okay. Was very pleasantly surprised and on some levels shocked at how much my evolved beliefs, meaning that they have evolved as my time as a pagan and my many, many years as a pagan, and how much I totally agree with the things that he's saying.
He's an interesting guy. He's very private, and I don't think it was until very recently that even a picture of him appeared on the internet, and no one's really sure if that's a picture of him. I know that he goes to pagan festivals, he attends pagan circles. At the same time, he's very much into ceremonial magic. He acknowledges the Lovecraftian Cthulhu deities. He can be very derisive of Thelema, of Aleister Crowley, even going so far as calling Horus the Brat Prince. That sure doesn't earn him any points with them. But he also acknowledges, you know, the foundations that were there and the things that Crowley opened up. Yes, I'm purposely mispronouncing that. That's how Ozzy Osbourne pronounces it. That's how I'm going to pronounce it.
Well, dear old Uncle Al.
We'll call him Uncle Al.
The man we love to hate. I mean, he did so much for modern paganism. He opened so many doors for us. He really was the magician of the past century. But I still wouldn't want to introduce him to any of my family members.
But you'd like to have a drink with him, right?
Maybe.
But I don't want him to be president, even though I want to have a drink with him.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I'd love to have a discussion across the table with him.
Peter J. Carroll, like I said, very private kind of guy. Also into quantum physics, big into quantum physics. A lot of his own magic delves into that. He's kind of the originator of chaos magic. It spawns out of the work of Austin Spahr and Crowley to some extent. But he formed a group called the Illuminates of Thanateros and was the head of that organization for quite some time.
Oh, look, there's a crow out there. He's peering over your shoulder because you're mispronouncing his namesake.
What? Who? Stop that. So sometimes he's referred to as Pope Pete. That's where I was getting at. So if you hear me talk about Pope Pete, that's Peter J. Carroll.
Okay.
When I first listened to this talk, I was just coming back to magic from a long absence, and it really changed everything for me. It brought it down to the bare bones where I understood what was going on underneath the hood. I understood why you did what you did. I understand why you practice every day, why rituals are constructed the way they are. So this talk, it really brought me back to magic and is why I consider myself a chaos magician, even though other chaos magicians might disagree, but that's okay. We're chaos magicians and that's what we do. So without further delay, let's go ahead and play that recording, and we'll come back and talk about it.
Great. Thanks.
Some general considerations on the philosophy and practice of magic now follow. The effectiveness of magic depends heavily on the skill and subtlety of those performing it, and on the careful choice of and preparation for a desired effect. In general, one should try and bring about events which have a measurable probability of occurring by chance alone, and one should not be too proud to do everything possible on the physical plane to help it occur. Thus, magic should be something thrown in to tip the scales of chance in one's favor when all possible physical action has been taken. By neglecting to maximize the probability on the physical plane, one sets up an internal conflict in which magic is expected to make up for poor preparation. Thus, in divination, one should not shy away from first exhausting all mundane sources of information that might be relevant, and in enchantment, assist the spell both before and after casting by all possible ordinary means. The purpose of performing magic is not to test the efficacy of magic. If it is performed in this spirit of challenge, the subconscious challenge for it to fail will be the only result which manifests. Magic is to be performed to get results, And even if one at first achieves results only a little better than chance, then it at least provides an edge which can be turned into a considerable advantage if subtly employed. One should always look for an avenue of reasonable probability through which chance can be bent towards desire. For example, the probability of spontaneously materializing a substantial fortune is rather low. And even doubling that probability by magic is unlikely to lead to success. On the other hand, even a small advantage in gambling or business can produce a decisive effect. Similarly, divination should be regarded as a means of distinguishing the correct information from amongst those alternatives of which one is aware or able to imagine. In magical acts of illumination, it is better to conjure initially for modest, specific improvements or even arbitrary changes to oneself rather than for ill-defined or grandiose modifications. Although the lore of magic is peppered with tales of really extreme and improbable events, remember that even the best of the magi rarely pull off more than a dozen such events in a lifetime. The aspiring magician should seek to work on the simpler schemes first and to immerse himself in the belief structures of magic, and the really great acts of power will gradually begin to manifest in his work. At any time in life, but most commonly in late youth, when we have the vague intuition that there is something profoundly bizarre and inconsistent about life, the universe, and everything, there may suddenly be a horrifying or ecstatic certainty that one's own self is illusory and that reality is also an illusion. One's carefully defended identity seems to be a pointless pretense and an empty shell. The world becomes a cacophony of meaningless sensations. Most people will reject this initiation and manage to fill their lives and identities with sufficient concerns until perhaps an awareness of mortality reminds them of it again. Those who do drink the poison must seek stronger medicine or become sick or mad. Rational materialism is the least powerful of the antidotes. Little more than an assertion of the reality of the ego or self-image and the reality of physical objects. Yet it works for some, and if they pursue it rigorously, they may become that much more effective in philosophy and science for the serpent's kiss. However, it does impart a veiled destructiveness to these endeavors. Religion and mysticism offer a different form of medicine. Transcendentalism is the acceptance of the emptiness of self and the unreality of phenomena as symptoms of our temporary estrangement from some greater fullness and reality, be it nirvana, God, or enlightenment. Those with a particularly deep terror of extinction and nothingness become the most passionately religious and mystical, precisely because that negation is always with them. Finally, there are those brought close to death by the serpent's bite, and those who found in the poison itself a source of freedom and laughter. These are the potential magicians. Debilitating and depressive maladies with no obvious cause were recognized as a shaman sickness in the old hunter-gatherer societies. If the sufferer could rebuild his identity or spirits, and hence his bodily health, with or without help from other shaman, then he could become a shaman himself. In our own culture, there is too much symptom-suppressive medicine, and there are too many subcultural identities available for this tradition to have survived. However, there are many who do become magicians after a struggle with illness, typically asthma, or after a struggle with the temptations of suicide. For some candidates, the serpent's bite is an ecstatic awakening, and they proceed directly to a purely magical answer without suffering. If the self is an elaborate pretense, and the world is without a fixed meaning, then one is free to be anybody and do anything. Such freedoms equip one well for the theater or espionage, or if one has a taste for tampering with the fabric of illusion itself, magic. After the absurdity and eventual collapse of their empire and class system, the British have often only the most tenuous grip on any kind of credible identity. And it is unsurprising that such a high proportion of notable spies, actors, and magicians should emerge from that race. Of course, there are many people who look to magic merely as a means of augmenting their lifestyle whilst retaining an essentially materialist or transcendental worldview. The materialist who dabbles in the occult is usually looking for something transcendental. He never finds it, because no proof or refutation of parapsychology really implies anything at all about the existence or non-existence of anything transcendental. Transcendentalists who dabble in magic usually obtain results as spectacular as they are useless. Quite quickly they are surrounded by demons and spirits, powers and principalities, and notebooks full of outlandish visions and communications. Soon, they are alternating between excessive humility and megalomania. Those who approach magic from a materialist or transcendental point of view may succeed in getting a few magical effects, but only an acceptance of magic on its own terms is likely to confer the persistence to actually become a magician. Thus it is worth contrasting the magical paradigm with the rational and transcendental paradigms to see how they might usefully be untangled from each other. Although the paradigms are not mutually exclusive, they do not fit comfortably together. Yet of all people, the magician is the least likely to feel that they should be forced to fit, and the contemporary magician has most to profit from a working understanding of each. The materialist, transcendental, and magical paradigms each recognize a different basis to reality. The materialist universe consists of matter and energy in space and time. The transcendentalist universe is created of spirit or consciousness. As there is no universally accepted word for the underlying reality of the universe in magical terms, I shall borrow and adapt the word mana. All magical systems are explicitly or implicitly structured around the recognition of mana in some guise or other. Mana cannot precisely be described in materialistic or transcendental terms, but as magical terms are rather limited in our culture, it is worth attempting these descriptions. Mana, in materialistic terms, is the information which structures matter, and which all matter and thought is capable of emitting and receiving across space and perhaps time. Mana, in transcendental terms, is a sort of life force present to some degree in all beings, objects, and events, and able to act between them. In magical terms, mana is the power which shapes phenomena, and which phenomena emit to shape other phenomena. It is also knowledge, in the sense that the shaping power imparts information. Mana is not synonymous with consciousness in the transcendental sense. Consciousness is no more than a word used to describe the sensation arising from mental activity. Mana is analogous to spirit only to the extent that spirit is taken to imply communicated information. Mana is not an attribute of matter, rather it is the other way around. Matter is the way in which mana most commonly appears to us. The so-called scientific laws of the material universe are an expression of mana. From a magical point of view, the laws of nature are incomplete. Future events are not entirely determined in advance. Mana acts chaotically within those arbitrary limits it has already invented. Thus, mana is creative and unpredictable in those situations where there are insufficient mana conventions to determine what will happen. And this includes everything more complex than clockwork. And it is here that magic or mana projection can be used to force the hand of chance. Divination must always be difficult or subject to large inaccuracies, because many aspects of the future are indeterminate. The decision to develop one's psychic powers primarily for enchantment, which is making things happen, rather than for divination, is a large part of actually becoming a magician. At many points in its history, magic has been heavily contaminated with mystical and religious beliefs. The term chaos magic is used to designate a philosophy of pure magic, unadulterated with transcendentalism. There are two basic principles underlying it, and these give structure to the magician's identity. The first is that mana is spontaneously self-creative. Mana creates itself in the manifestation of phenomena and events, and having created arbitrarily, tends to stick to a pattern. Thus the universe is arbitrary within arbitrary limits. There are ultimately no reasons for the laws of the universe. They arise chaotically and take on the appearance of causality by repetition. Now these arbitrary limits are less confining than most people think. The sun will rise and water will still run downhill tomorrow, but much of what will happen is at this moment still undecided. For the magician, the core of the microcosm and macrocosm doctrine is that man and the universe are both based on the random, chaotically creative powers of mana, and that both have considerable power to exercise that freedom. Thus, in the magical paradigm, there is no need to debate free will versus determinism. Any sufficiently complicated system will exhibit some random behavior, and if we choose to identify with our random behavior and call it free will, then we should be prepared to affirm that the weather, for example, also has a degree of free will. All this soon leads the magician to the recognition that it is he who has effectively created much of his own universe by investing or withdrawing meaning or belief in various parts of the surrounding reality. This is likely to lead the magician, particularly the younger magician, into some fairly extreme forms of behavior as he tests his mana against that of the arbitrary conventions in the environment. A certain perversity, iconoclasm, and antinomianism is likely to color his extreme individualism. He is as likely to experimentally deify some rough-hewn fetish as he is to desecrate what others hold sacred. To survive in this mode requires a considerable lightness of touch. A huge sense of humor is all that stands between the magician and social ostracism or madness. He would be the first to proclaim that when the possibilities of common sense prove insufficient, one can often make nonsense deliver the goods. The second core principle of magic is also subsumed within the microcosm and macrocosm doctrine. Because mana penetrates everywhere, all parts reflect the whole, and the magician is at least potentially in instantaneous two-way contact with all phenomena. In practice, a magical link is required. The magician must possess some image or memory or a connection to some material substance through which mana can operate. Mana operates between phenomena of similar type. Transmitter and receiver must share common characteristics. Like attracts like. The magician aims to establish certain symmetries between the inner and outer landscapes. Being aware that mana is playing a game with itself and making up the rules, prizes, and forfeits as it goes along, he decides that it would be more fun if he were to cheat a little himself. To do this, he must first prepare his internal landscape. It is basically the great variety of methods of preparing the internal landscape which accounts for the rich diversity of magical identities and magical symbol systems. The practice of visualization is basic to them all, however. Visualization should also be understood to include intense ideation, sustained emotion, and other forms of mental focusing, concentration, and imagination. It is a state bordering on hysteria in the clinical sense, where the whole of the attention is directed towards some particular focus. It is usefully augmented by various physiological practices, ranging from sensory deprivation to frenzied ecstasy, that are collectively known as methods of attaining single-pointed awareness, or gnosis. The oldest magical systems, known as shamanism, populated the internal landscape with the spirits of natural phenomena, diseases, plants, and particularly animals, in an attempt to gain control over these phenomena. Nowadays, a number of neo-shaman practice identification with animal form, not so much for hunting purposes, but as a gateway to gnosis in which to perform other magics. In religious periods, magicians have usually filled their internal landscapes with angelic or demonic images. Each entity would have some specific function in the world, and each wizard would have a grimoire detailing the connections he had forged between the parts of his inner landscape, conceptualized as entities, and the outer landscape, the world. In their Baroque symbolism, both the shaman and the goetic theurgic traditions reflect the fact that it is considerably easier to handle the internal landscape if one fills it up with spectacular and emotive artifacts. The continuing popularity of Satanism amongst agnostics is testimony enough to this. There is some reality to the tradition of demonic packs. Whatever is accepted into the internal landscape becomes part of you and will grow if fed. There is always a danger that design faults in an internal landscape lead to a progressive detachment from the external landscape. Then he who would be a magician ends up merely as an internal landscape gardener, or mystic, as he usually dignifies himself. Modern Kabbalah, in which I include the whole vast overflown edifice of correspondences between archaic pantheons, metals, plants, stones, tarot, and astrology, can often be more of an obstruction than an aid to magic. Those who attempt to use the system in its entirety tend to be too preoccupied with patching incongruent maps to each other and to their experience of the outer landscape to actually do much effective magic. Partly as a reaction to such stultifying systematization, and partly out of a desire to evolve a pure magic which is structuralist, eclectic, and free of transcendental contaminants, a freestyle tradition is developing. The principles behind the freestyle or chaos tradition are that there is usually plenty of material already in one's internal landscape, that deficiencies can be made good by blatant invention or theft of appealing symbols from any other system, and that all methods of gnosis are interchangeable. Nothing is sacred unless one finds it is useful to regard it as so. The personal arcanum is a natural source for internal landscape material. Everyone will find themselves richly endowed with fears, terrors, lusts, and desires if they look. And what better material to manufacture gods and demons from is there? Past lives, explored or even invented in trance, dream, or reverie, can also be a key to the world within us, as can work with atavisms, the backward exploration of genetic memory to tap the powers of beasts. To re-establish participation in natural phenomena, the magician may need to re-mythologize his internal landscape. It is easier to call down lightning or quell a sea storm via one's concept of Thor or Poseidon than it is by direct will alone. The reason for this, and indeed for the oblique nature of most spells in general, is that our unconscious is far better at magic than our conscious mind. Sigils, spell procedures, and entity visualizations keep the conscious mind occupied with a complex tangential activity while sending a simple message, insulated from conscious interference, to the mighty subconscious. Some magicians find it expedient to create fetishes and visualizations of machine entities for psychic interaction with computers or complex and temperamental mechanical devices. The same principle applies to divination. The conscious mind is deliberately preoccupied with manipulating a net of symbols in which clairvoyant messages from the psychic subconscious can be caught. The subconscious is a highly imprecise term drawn from materialist psychology. Nothing is ever forgotten, but some things are more easily recalled than others. There is no serviceable magical equivalent, because magicians never found such distinctions of this type useful. Nevertheless, the doctrine of the subconscious is a useful way of reminding the rationalist that there is more to him than his ego admits, As sunlight obscures the stars by day, so does wakefulness obscure the fact that we are still dreaming. Any serious exploration of the possibilities of the internal landscape should eventually force the magician into the materialization that he is more than a single being. The rational ego of materialist psychologists and the single soul or God of monotheist religions are merely tricks we have been taught to make us more predictable and controllable. The fact remains that when one is angry, lustful, terrified, in love, or 10 years older or younger than one is, one no longer is who one is at present. The magician, who may at times experience himself as the horned god, a bear, an empty void, a spirit medium, or a businessman, should come to realize that there is no fundamental need for consistency. Once free of the illusion of self, he does not need to rationalize his activities into a consistent ego pattern, or order them into a spiritual unity. It must be said that many magicians, perhaps the majority, effectively abort their further development by making a disastrous mistake here. During his career, a magician will accrete various secondary identifications to match or balance his personality. Thus he may work in the magus teacher light charismatic mode, or the joker initiator dark reclusive mode, or a mixture of these. This will affect his tertiary identifications, which are basically the lifestyle and symbolic system he chooses. The secondary and tertiary identifications are merely tools which the magician uses, and not in themselves of any danger to the magician. A primary identification is made when the magician accepts some goal or power or ideal as absolute and outside of himself. In technical terms, this mistake is known as discovering one's holy guardian angel. The magician becomes a tool of his obsession. Beyond this point, the magician can make little progress. He has lost his fluidity because he has filled or obscured the creative, magical, chaotic void at the center of his self with a partial and artificial conception. In effect, he has simply become a transcendentalist or ideologue by a very roundabout route, even if he still dabbles in magic. But for the true magician, nothing is true and everything is permitted, which is to say that all ultimate truths are lies and that anything he does is justified simply by his doing it. By accepting that he is a colonial being, the magician is able to unlock the wealth within. He whose name is Legion can do anything, and that is, of course, what the priests and politicians have always been afraid of.
And we are back. Colleen, your first impressions.
As I said, I started out listening to this expecting to disagree with him. And I even tried to disagree with him.
See, I thought you'd disagree with him because of some of what he says smacks of Satanism.
You'll have to help me with that because I'm not sure that I caught that.
At the end, where he's talking about a truly free magician is able to take on a persona to take advantage of any situation and not have any center, not have any core, and be legion. That's kind of a satanic point of view.
That's only satanic if you're coming at it from a biblical aspect. I mean, you know, you could quote the Bible where Jesus came along and cast out demons and they were named Legion and he sent them into the pigs and then the pigs jumped off the cliff. But a modern Satanist is totally hedonistic. At least that is part of the definition. I'm not talking necessarily about the Church of Set, but more Anton LaVey. I don't think that that's what Peter was saying. I think Peter was talking, even though he didn't come right out and say it, that while everything is permissible, it doesn't mean that everything is advantageous to you, or that just because you can do something, you should do something.
Yeah, you know, I think he portrays that whole chaos magic motto, everything is true, nothing is permitted, is a refinement of do as thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And just because, you know, just like Crowley, you know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something.
Exactly. And one of the things that I had to pause about was when he was talking about absolute truth. And it took me back to a time when I was out at a painting group I used to frequent, back when I was into watercolor painting. And for the most part, they were a group of very fundamentalist Christians. We actually met in the fellowship room of a Christian church. And they would talk about absolute truth. And I would ask them, what is an absolute truth? And they would answer something like, gravity. You can't fly because gravity holds you to the earth. And I said, well, that only applies in the physical universe that we're inhabiting right at this moment. That doesn't take in all of time, space, existence, or all of that universe that Peter refers to as our construct, our personal construct of reality. Of course, they couldn't understand that. And where they were really going was the absolute truth was whatever God said. I am the way, the truth, and the light. No man cometh unto the Father but by me.
That's funny, because this past Sunday, I was reading my Tumblr, like I do, and you know, there's a lot of kids on there who worship Neil deGrasse Tyson and Carl Sagan, and I'm fine with those guys. But they can be very hardcore atheists. And one quote from Tyson was, you know, it's okay if you don't believe in science. Science still works. And then I went and read this book by a fundamentalist friend of mine. And, you know, she says in there, it's okay if you don't believe in God. God's still there. And I had to laugh because both perspectives are wrong, in my opinion. You know, what's really important is what we can see and experience, and what we base our actions on that, and the kind of arbitrary laws of science that sometimes doesn't apply.
I know that sometimes people think that I'm a little quirky because I tell them that there have been times when I have bent time. I can recall times when I had to make a 40-minute drive and I got there in 15 minutes. And I don't remember the trip and I couldn't tell you how it happened, but by the clock, I could tell you that it did happen. And one of them was when a friend of mine fell and was seriously ill and I had to rush her to the hospital and she lived 20 miles away.
Okay.
That's why I don't believe in absolute truths. Because I believe that when we put everything that we have into accomplishing a task outside of our scope of our own influence, meaning that we don't even think about how we're going to influence it, but that we just act, that sometimes magic comes into our lives and allows us to do something that the laws of physics say should be impossible.
Absolutely. And, you know, even if you're following the psychological model of magic, even if you believe it's all in your head, if you believe in absolute truths, then what you're saying is that there are parts of your subconscious that are unchangeable. And that's just silly. I mean, you can go to bed every night and prove that to be false. I mean, dreams have no rules. And your subconscious, I don't think, has any. Magic doesn't have any. Reality, like Peter J. Carroll says, these rules are arbitrary within arbitrary limits.
Right, and he talks about the things that we do as practice, magical practice, are a way to focus our conscious minds and to get them out of the way so our subconscious can work.
Yeah.
And I think that when those times of magic happen, and by the way, science is what modern medicine or modern science has proved was the magic that our ancestors talked about. And we're only now becoming to understand what those things are, like quantum physics and how particles can move and all of those kinds of things. But I think that it's only when we get out of the way of our conscious mind, all of that stuff that has been drilled into us as truth, when we move that, then there is room for new stuff to come in and for us to bend or warp those quote-unquote supposed truth laws.
And you can truly embrace the idea that you can do anything.
Yes.
And for me, bringing this back to that moral question that we kind of started out with, once you come to the realization that everything is influenced by you, that you can do anything, then you're responsible for everything.
Exactly.
So, you know, if I don't want to suffer, then don't create suffering. If I want the world to change, then I have to change the world. There's going to be other forces out there against me. You know, Rupert Murdoch, he's a good magician. He's hard to fight, but that's, you know, if you are a magician, then you're responsible.
And even before being able to change the world, we must change ourselves.
Sure.
And I know that at one point in time, you and I had a previous discussion and I was talking about channeling. And at one point in time, I had a mentor from South Africa. His name was Andre. I never met Andre. He lived way down in South Africa. I've forgotten the name of the city now. But we talked on the internet a lot. We'd call on internet phone. And he always thought that I was going to be a channeler for him. And
after he was dead or while he was alive?
No, while he was alive.
Okay.
And he thought that I was going to be the channeler that would help him understand things.
Okay.
Because he didn't have the capability of doing so. But I had this innate fear about it. And the whole idea just shook me.
So, in a sense, he wanted you to be Edward Kelly to his John Dee?
I think that's probably a good way to put it. After all, my name is Kelly.
Yeah. But there you go.
Oh, well. At any rate, one night, in the middle of the night, I woke up and I realized that as a small child, I had been taken to church and I had been taught that talking to the spirits was a sin that you couldn't really be forgiven for. Mm-hmm. It was like blasphemy against the Holy Spirit. And that way down deep there was the fear that had come into my life that would not let me get past that. And when I looked at that, I took it out. I mean, I physically view myself as taking something out of my inner core. I hold it in my hand and I look at it and I turn it over and I look at it and I examine it and then I release it. I don't want it as part of me anymore.
Simple visualization magic.
Yes. Sympathetic magic is kind of what I refer to it as. And after that point in time, I began to open myself to the spirits, to the point now where I'm not a ceremonial magician. I don't do the kind of practice that you do every day. But when I'm in group and a message needs to be passed on, I just wait for the gods to come into me. I invoke them. Mm-hmm. And I let them speak through me. I get out of the way. And most of the time, I have no idea what I say. But people often tell me I'm pretty wise.
You know, I had the same problems growing up Catholic and with the whole, you know, burden of sin and that sort of thing. And I basically did the same thing, except my way is a lot more complicated. I started working with Goetia, which, you know, to the church, that's total sin, blasphemy, demons, bad, even though they invented it. And
well, and we also know that the gods of the previous culture always become the demons of the new culture when people conquer any peoples.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're reading through the Lesser Key of Solomon and you find the phoenix on the list of examples, it's hard to take these as the bad guys. But still doing that, and I approached it from a demonic sense. And I think that's important. That's how you approach it. That I was bringing up these demons to confront the dark side in me, to bend it to something constructive, and at the same time, destroy the things that were standing in my way. Or you could just reach inside and have a ball of light and chuck it off and be done with it. But I have to do it the hard way or else it doesn't work for me.
Well, I love the show Once Upon a Time, bringing it right back into modern culture. I don't know whether you watch that show or not, yeah. But it's kind of the Snow White fairy tale.
Okay.
I don't even know what channel it's on, but, you know, I cue it up and I watch it. And one of the things that the evil queen does is she has the ability to reach inside your chest and take out your heart. And then that way she controls you. Well, that's kind of the way I examine things. I reach inside of myself and I pull them out and I hold them in my hand and then I look at them. And as I have taken them out and I examine them, then they no longer have the power that they had before. And sometimes, because I'm a creature of habit and because I go back and think about things and overanalyze things, sometimes I have to do that time and time and time again because I haven't gotten the very root of it out.
A guy you should go and read, a modern chaos magician named Andre Vidimus. Hi, Andre. He does a podcast, Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. A lot of his magic's like that.
I'll have to look him up.
So back to Pope Pete.
Okay.
What did you disagree with? You had to pick at it.
I know. I did have to pick at it. I mean, some of the things that he said about some of the terms that he used, like he said that, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said that potential magicians, those brought close to death by the serpent's bite, and those who find the poison itself a source of freedom and laughter. I don't think in those kinds of terms. I have no issue with serpents, but the idea of poison is something that in my magical practice I don't deal with because it's typically a more negative basis. And oftentimes he would use terms and words in a manner that was different than my understanding of them. And so I have to then look at those things and say, well, what does he mean by this? And I understood after listening to it two or three times that he was really talking about the change that happens within us as we open up and become. He was talking about the transition of shaman. How do they become shaman? Or magicians, what draws them in? And it's that experience that then begins to spread through your mind, body, and soul.
Like the Zulu with their shamans.
Yes.
Get hit by lightning. That's how you become a shaman. And, you know, obviously he was waxing poetic
yes.
at that point. But, you know, you can also see the poison as being the apple from the Garden of Eden, which is kind of how I see it. You know, mm-hmm. Here's freedom. And that's a poison in as much that other people now are going to look at you and be afraid because you stopped really caring what they think about what you do.
Even more than that, because you think freely, you threaten what they do. And when you threaten what someone else does, even if it's innocent, just by being you, then it causes them to fear. And when people fear, they can become dangerous.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, as far as other stuff within it, like using the terms mana, and one that I've heard argued a lot is the use of the term gnosis. A lot of people associate it with Gnosticism, and they're like, this has nothing to do with Gnosticism and that. And it's like, oh, it doesn't. Except it does. But
gnosis simply means to know, to understand.
Right. And he openly says, you know, our culture doesn't have very good terms for these things. So he just steals what he needs and changes it to what he needs to describe.
Right. As I told you earlier, I had to go look up some of his terms. Mana was one of them. I was remembering 25, 30 years ago, there was this Christian rap singer, and he sang this song, So You Want to Go Back to Egypt, and they even did the little, you know, Egyptian dance where they're making the arm movements and stuff like that. And this guy sung about manna falling from heaven, and how great it would be just to find, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner on the lawn in the morning and things like that, and how attractive that is when you're faced with freedom.
Yeah.
Because freedom can be frightening and scary, and then you have to figure out what your will is. You have to determine where it is you want to go, and how do you get there? You don't have a leader to take you by the hand and to guide you down the path.
You might learn the difference between good and evil, and then when God screws you over, you'll know it. Wait.
when an entity screws you over, a spirit.
Sure. Okay. But you did find the definition of mana as in taken from Polynesian belief, right?
I did. Okay. I did, very much so. And he pretty much boils it down to being what I think of as the basis of all life, being energy.
Right.
All things are made of energy. He uses the term mana. I would use the term energy. Therefore, we all vibrate at different levels of energy, and we have different amounts of energy flow.
And the great thing about the use of the term mana, all you gaming geeks out there, Magic the Gathering players, they know exactly what he's talking about, because they throw points of mana. But as far as mana, the part of it that I appreciated it is it also is about information. And a lot of my practice is viewing the universe not so much as in terms of energy, but in terms of information. You know, this is why my main god, shall I say, I am devoted to Thoth. Let's not go that far. I don't want to have that burden.
The word, speak forth the word. In the beginning was the word.
Right. And my magic is based on words. And so I appreciate that idea that mana is not only energy, it is information.
Right. I consider information to be a form of energy as well. And a little while ago, I talked about Andre. And there would be times when Andre would call me up, and it would be the middle of the night. And he would say, "You're transmitting to me." And
I can't sleep. You need to turn it off.
And yes, he would tell me things like that. But interestingly enough, he would also tell me what I had been dreaming.
Yeah.
So therefore, I know that that information was being transmitted to him, that he indeed was a receiver, and it always fascinated me how he could possibly know those things when I had never met him and we were thousands upon thousands of miles apart.
Never saw him, never touched him. Wow.
I saw a photo of him once.
That's crazy. God bless the internet.
Exactly.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention? Anything else that you wanted to throw out there? Because I think we're getting pretty close to our time.
Well, I think that I wanted to say that Peter also brought up the fact that we effectively create our own universe. And that is, I do a lot of following of Don Miguel Ruiz, and I believe in his philosophy of the Four Agreements. And he talks so much about us creating our own universes, and he talks about us having control over that. We are a shared dream. I have my own dream. You come into my dream. I share that with you, and together we co-create.
The collective unconscious.
The collective unconscious. Therefore, my creation and your creation merge into something that it could not possibly be had we both not come together and shared the mana, the information, the exchange of energy that he talks about.
I have a tagline that I use on my writer's site as a writer that, you know, writers and magicians do essentially the same thing. They create worlds with words and will. So I think that's kind of along the same lines, that we're creating this world together. That's why we're responsible for it. In fact, Peter J. Carroll, one of his current projects you should really look up, he is a dean at an online magic college, Arcanium College. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. One of the courses he teaches is Knights of Chaos. And the goal of the Knights of Chaos is to use magic to help influence climate change, to slow things down, influence our leaders to make sure that we're not going to destroy ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, while you could take nothing is true, everything is permitted as a license to go out and do whatever the fuck you want, you know, it's obvious by the guy who started chaos magic that that's not what he meant. I think that's it.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this.
Okay. Well, we'll have another one of these wonderful conversations sometime within the next month. We'll try to put one of these out for you.
Hey, and if you have a topic that you would like James and I and maybe somebody from another magical path to discuss, please let us know.
That's right. You can find our email, contacts, and all that good stuff at scrolofthoth.com. You can sign up for our mailing list there. You can follow me on Tumblr. That's pretty much the only social media that I use.
And you can find me on Facebook as Colleen Kelly.
That's easy enough. I have a book coming out, a serialized novel.
I've read it. It's pretty good.
It's just pretty good.
I've only read one chapter or one part.
That's coming April 30th to Amazon Kindle, called My Babylon. A lot in there about actual magical practice. Do you have anything going on you want to let people know about?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
In case they're in jail, you have pagan prison ministries, but
certainly.
You don't want to encourage that.
I also wanted to, please don't go to jail just to find me. I'll get me on Facebook. But I am also one of the founders of Novices of the Old Ways Midwest, and you can find us on Facebook as Novices of the Old Ways Midwest. Very open, eclectic group. We do all of the 8 high holidays and get together for classes and teaching besides that. So come on over and join us.
And they take that novices thing seriously, where they're out to teach. Everyone is considered a learner. I think that's all we have time for. Thank you again to Original Falcon Press for letting us use Philosophy and Practice of Magic. The music for this podcast is by Nine Inch Nails from their album Ghosts. Ghosts was released under the Creative Commons license, making it free to use for all your non-commercial endeavors. And we'll see you again soon.